TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. Highly praised by Noam Chomsky as inspiring us to abolish what he calls the colossal folly of nuclear weapons, Professor Elaine Scarry proposes how to accomplish that task in her book, Thermonuclear Monarchy. She argued in part one of this program that nuclear weapons are incompatible with democracy. Nuclear weapons imperil the whole surface of the Earth, even if only 0.01% of the world arsenal is used. 44 million will die on the first day and 1 billion in the first month. However, we have the tools through which we can demand that these weapons be disarmed. Elaine Scarry argues that the Constitution and Bill of Rights hold two clauses that can be used to control and disarm nuclear weapons. The first such clause is the right of Congress to declare war, laid down in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the U.S. Constitution. By curious coincidence, the last time there was a formal congressional declaration of war was for World War II. Since the advent of nuclear weapons that make control over war ever more urgent, not one of the wars the U.S. began since then has had congressional authorization. Part of the reason that Congress has become, in Scarry's words, so foolish and powerless lies in the fact that they lost their most important decision-making power, which needs to be regained. The second provision that can help safeguard nuclear weapons, to everybody's surprise, is the Second Amendment, protecting the right of the people to keep and bear arms. This very provocative statement will be dealt with now in the radio program you are about to hear. Elaine Scarry spoke on January 11, 2015, at the Wellington Avenue Church, Chicago. She's professor of aesthetics and general theory of value at Harvard. Thermonuclear Monarchy is her most recent book. Elaine Scarry.
The second provision of the Constitution that tries to provide a kind of impediment in the way of going to war, it doesn't mean we can't go to war, but it puts an impediment, a testing, in the way of it, is the right to bear arms. Now, this is a more controversial argument in my book, as in the case of the requirement for a congressional declaration of war. A very long chapter is devoted to showing the truth of this. Today, the country is divided between people who just love guns and think that that the right to bear arms is there to ensure their right to carry guns for hunting and to protect themselves against criminals, and those people in more liberal circles and universities who don't even want to hear the words right to bear arms. And in fact, the Second Amendment is really conforms to neither of these two views. The Second Amendment is a very great amendment, and what it is designed to do is to make sure that there is distributed to the whole country responsibility to oversee the country's collective injuring power. It doesn't say how much injuring power we have. We might have a lot, we might have none at all. It's anterior to that. It says however much we have, it's going to be equally divided between all of us. And the reason for that is that the only way to hold military power in a civil frame is to cut it up into small pieces and to make sure that it's being looked at by each person, as tends to happen when there is a draft. So this is obviously something that it would take a long time for me to spell out in detail, but there's a couple of key points that I should make. First of all, as in the case with the Congressional Declaration, where it means that before we invade a country, and by the way, I should say that presidents have come to feel that if they have the power to annihilate another country, why should they have to bother to get Congressional Declaration merely if they're going to invade former Yugoslavia or invade Haiti or Panama or Afghanistan. In fact, the elder Bush said, I didn't have to get permission from some old goat in Congress to go into Kuwait and kick Saddam Hussein out of there. The Constitution requires that you put 535 layers of intervening humanity between the thought of going into war and the actual doing of it. The right to bear arms includes many, many more intervening layers of possibly resistant humanity. If you imagined it to be the whole American adult population, it would be 250 million people. If you said, well, in 17th and 18th century wars, there was only 3% of the population involved, that would still be 9 million people who would be debating it and talking about it, instead of what we have today, which is, with the exception of people in peace action and equivalent groups, no discussion when we go into war, merely turning on the TV to see what our country, namely what the president and the military, are going to do, instead of all of us taking responsibility for assessing it and seeing whether we ought to be doing it. The second point to make is people often say soldiers are mindless automatons who follow orders. Nothing could be further from the truth. I've studied many, many different wars, and in all of them you see examples of the fact that countries only go to war if the soldiers consent to it, and they often dissent. We, of course, all know this from Vietnam. And that dissent not only happened at the threshold, it happened at the interior. For example, in 1 year alone, in 1971, 33,000 soldiers, American soldiers, deserted from Vietnam. In Iraq, in the recent war in Iraq, in 2004, in 1 year, 2,300 soldiers deserted. In the first 6 months of 2007, 5,000 people deserted, and the Department of State took the numbers off their website so you could no longer follow them. But what we're seeing there is true of every war. For example, in the Civil War, a wonderful scholar from the 1920s, El Alon, has shown that there were desertions on both sides, North and South. But as the war was going on, more and more people were deserting from the South, until in the end, 250,000 Southern soldiers deserted. And that's how we won, in part, how we won the Civil War. I quote in the book all these reports issued by Robert E. Lee, where he essentially is reporting, I looked behind me and there was no one there. 100 people deserted today, 250 people deserted today, 35 people deserted today. Soldiers are not automatons. They are not drones who simply carry out an execution that they're ordered to do. They think, they test. I could go on, citing examples. At the end of World War I, for example, Winston Churchill wanted to take the soldiers into Russia to stand with the whites against the Reds. He writes to Lloyd George, I couldn't do it. The soldiers wouldn't let me. There were soldier strikes in 19 different cities in England, and also in Canada, and also in India, and elsewhere among British soldiers saying, enough, we aren't going to do this anymore. So I'm not trying to paint a portrait of soldiers as always dissenters. I'm saying that when they consent, when the country goes to war, it's because the soldiers have been convinced of the need to do that. And this is something that generals always acknowledge. For example, Napoleon said, moral factors are to physical factors by a ratio of 4-1. Moral factors are the consent of the soldier. Montgomery, a general during World War II, said, in war, morale of the soldiers isn't one factor, it's the only factor. So they know very well that they have to work hard to persuade the soldiers to go. And then the next point that I would quickly make is that civil stature follows from military stature in the United States and elsewhere as well. Here's a couple of quick examples of that. The 15th Amendment, extending the right to vote to African Americans, was argued primarily on the basis that 180,000 blacks had fought in the Civil War and couldn't be deprived of the right to vote. The 19th Amendment, giving the right to vote to women, was almost as strongly linked to the right of self-defense. It said that women can defend themselves and they can also help in the defense of their country. There were many suffrage pageant plays and ceremonies that showed that. Most recently, the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age from 21 to 18, was argued on the basis that both the soldiers who fought in Vietnam and the college students who fought on university campuses against that war had earned for themselves and future generations the right to vote at a younger age. That's wording from the congressional debate on this issue. And people from both liberal and conservative sides said this is the most civically sophisticated generation we've ever had. They deserve to vote at a younger age and to have all people coming along voting at a younger age. So if we've now all lost military rights, we have no military say, then we've also lost civic stature, even if we don't realize it. Now, we want to have time for a discussion, so I want to stop shortly, but I just want to say that that's the first third of the book, what I've just said to you about the two constitutional provisions. But the book goes on from there to talk about social contract theory. And just as the existence of nuclear weapons has made our Constitution look like something that we might or might not choose to follow, so too, nuclear weapons have distorted social contract theory to such an extent that Thomas Hobbes is often cited as though he would approve of nuclear weapons. He has been made the kind of a spokesman or the figurehead for a neo-realist school of international conflict that allows the leader of each state to determine what's going to happen to the fate of everyone else in the world. And this is simply about as far from what Thomas Hobbes is. So later chapters try to show that for Thomas Hobbes, as for Locke, the social contract is a contract for peace. That's why constitutions all over the world have the word peace either in the prelude or in the one of the early articles of the Constitution. And that he actually, as with our own U.S. Constitution, sees both the assembly, the parliament, and the individual soldier as the break on going to war. It doesn't mean you can't go to war, it just means it has to be tested before you do. I think I'll stop there except to say that two things. First, only injuries that haven't yet happened can be stopped, and we do have the power to stop them. If thousands of people turned out and helped President Obama dismantle these things, that could happen. And I believe that people of all faiths and all races can work together on this. And that reminds me to tell you that a book has just come out called African Americans Against the Bomb. That is, I think, a very important book that shows that African Americans have been in the forefront since 1945 in opposing nuclear weapons for reasons that I can summarize for you if we have time during the discussion period. And then the second thing to say is that, again, the time to try and undo this is before it happens, not after it happens. John Locke quotes a passage from an earlier writer that says that Caligula, a tyrant from history, Caligula had but one wish, and that was that the whole population had a single neck so he could dispatch them at a single blow. Nuclear weapons have literalized that. We have presidential first use policy, and presidents and other leaders in the nuclear states can dispatch the whole world's people as well as snowy owls and flowers and ponderoso pine trees and everything we love in a single blow. And it's our responsibility to try and undo that. Thank you for listening. So his first question, and tell me if I don't have this right, is it really the case that that after carrying out a revolution in which it had been hard to raise sufficient armies, that our fathers literally tried to encumber the process of going to war in the Constitution they wrote? That's question one. Question two is about right to bear arms. So the answer to the question, first question is yes, absolutely. And here's what's interesting. When the Constitution was written, the assembly that was deciding on the form of the Constitution decided that in going to war, it had to be the biggest body within the federal government that oversaw our entry into war. They explicitly debated, should it be the president acting alone? Should it be just the Senate? And they explicitly said, no, it has to be the biggest body, the legislative body. And they said that, in fact, you could have a smaller body arranging for peace. The Senate alone can do that. But you need to have the biggest body doing the overseeing the entry into war. When Justice Joseph Story in the 19th century reviewed that provision, he said, now you can argue that in going to war it's an emergency, we need to be act fast, therefore why involve all these people? But the answer, he said, is that thousands of people are going to die, the blood and treasure of the country is going to be spent. Often the result of war is that one of the two countries ceases to exist. Therefore, he said, it ought to be very difficult to get into war, and you ought to have every branch of government involved in it. Now, Madison, going back to the earlier moment, said it would not be unreasonable to even ask for not just a majority vote, but a two-thirds vote of each house because of the importance of this. Now, here's the interesting thing. The original Constitution did not have any of the first 10 amendments. Most of us, if we were asked what's important about the Constitution, would say First Amendment, right of assembly, right of free speech, right of religion, Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, free trial provisions, etc. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, did not come about at the Federal Assembly. They came about as a result of the ratification process in which the Constitution went out to the states, and the states debated whether they were going to pass the Constitution. And a number of states said, we're only going to do this if it's assumed that we'll get amendments, one of which was the right to bear arms. So Madison agreed. They would rather than starting all over, rewriting the Constitution, they would put in the amendments. So interestingly, you have the Assembly saying, who gets to decide going into war? The largest possible part of the government, the full assembly. Then it goes out to the people of the United States, the states, and they say, who gets to decide about going to war? The people. Each of them takes the largest possible unit and says it has to be there in going to war. Madison felt, on the basis of the right to bear arms, why do you even need to spell that out in the Constitution? After all, and this would be true if we only had conventional weapons. Let's say we only had rifles. Now follow Hamilton and Madison's thinking on this, and I think I have the quotes here because the quotes are so wonderful that I ought to give them to you. Both of them say, why do you need to write this out? The fact that you have to call out your citizens to help you in a war means that you can't possibly go forward without their authorization. So why do you even have to write an amendment that says that? And let me just give you Hamilton's saying, what he says. Is it probable that such a conspiracy between the legislature and the executive to permit such a menace would exist at all? That is, to do something that the people didn't want? Is it probable that it would be persevered in and transmitted along through all the successive variations in a representative body? Is it presumable? Can it be supposed that there would not be found one man discerning enough to detect so atrocious a conspiracy, or bold or honest enough? Madison goes even further. What he says in Federalist number 46 is that the idea of imagining an executive with a fixed plan for the extension of the military establishment, that the government and the people of the state should silently and patiently behold the gathering storm and continue to supply the materials until it should be prepared to burst on their own heads, is preposterous. And yet, what we have is a gathering of materials ready to burst over our own heads without our being able to say anything, because we're not required to carry the guns onto the battlefield, and therefore we don't have to be given the reasons why we're going to war against those people. In fact, we don't even know, as in the case of 9 of the 10 instances in which we've almost used nuclear weapons, we don't even know about them. You know, I alluded to the fact that there may be things in our own period. There are certainly times in our own period where presidents consider using them. And I'll just give you one example. On 9/11, President Bush, you remember, flew around in Air Force One, which is fine. Of course he should do that. He could well assume Washington and the White House is a target. Where did he stop? Off at Air Force Base in Nebraska. Off at Air Force Base, prior to 9/11, was in every newspaper account of it, described as the nerve center of our nuclear force. And furthermore, of our nuclear force, not only against states, but against terrorists. Now, stop and think, what does it mean, a nuclear retaliation against a terrorist? You have 5 or 18 or 30 men who decide to do some terrible piece of destruction on a country, and now we're going to take a nuclear weapon and injure millions of people? Did anyone bring this up when he stopped it off at Air Force Base? Did the 9/11 Commission report say, why did they stop it off at Air Force Base? Yes, they asked why it was, and they decided it was because they had enough facilities there to accommodate all the people on Air Force One. Do you think that every Air Force Base in the United States didn't have beds enough for everyone on Air Force One? No, of course they did. Now, your second question was, in this terrible situation we're in with arms in this country, where I think, if I understand you correctly, where arms are being used to harm people, am I understanding you correctly? How can we possibly hope that the right to bear arms could ever be benignly used to prevent or to even give us all a say about whether we go into Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, etc.? And here's the answer to that. Again, I'm not talking about actually distributing arms. We could debate that, whether you have to actually distribute the arms. What I'm talking about is distributing authorization over the arms. Gandhi, who we all know is a pacifist, said, of all the evil committed by England against India, the worst is the disarming of the population. Give us back our arms, and then we'll tell you whether we're going to use them. And of course, his argument was, we're not going to use them. But you don't even have the power to say that unless you actually have some authority over the military power of the country. Right now, the only people who are taken seriously on military weapons are people who have actually themselves been in missile silos, like Bruce Blair, or who have been former secretaries of defense, or people like Robert McNamara, who says nuclear weapons are illegal, immoral, dreadfully dangerous, and have to be eliminated right away in our own country. And those people are listened to, and they should be listened to, and I thank goodness for their existence every day. But the ordinary population is treated dismissively as peaceniks, or hippies, or people who, what's sometimes called in the media, ban the bombers, as though human beings don't have what in Switzerland is called equality of survival. We all have an equal right to wish to survive, and we all have an equal responsibility for making sure that human beings and all creatures on Earth survive. So it can't be that only people who have the power to fire the missiles also, once they retire, have the power to say, by the way, folks, these should be eliminated tomorrow, which is what a lot of retired military and defense people do say. Again, let me just say something I said that I think you missed. It doesn't mean we have to distribute arms. It means we have to distribute authorization over arms. It's not at all a matter of saying, let's each get a gun by any means. Now, when you say that they didn't debate individuals and they didn't say resist the government, that is entirely incorrect, and the chapter is loaded with examples, not at the Federal Assembly, but during the ratification debates and in the pamphlets that are going on. The pamphleteering, they are absolutely saying that individuals have to have arms. They even talk about what the kind of arms are. They even talk about the importance of having them be uniform arms across the whole population. They talk about the fact that the dangers from your own central government are possibly as bad as from a foreign invader, that there's no difference between being tyrannized over by your central government and a foreign government. They say that repeatedly. And if the military power is only held by the three of us and none of you, it may be that we're the nicest people in the world and you feel at ease. But Justice Brown in the 19th century said, no population has the right to assume that it will always have wise and generous leaders. That's why you have to have a rule of law and not a rule of men. You have to go by what the law says. And we have a policy of presidential first use. They are ready to go. They certainly have to be now guarded with everything every country has, absolutely. And there are lots of people working on different forms of verification so that that you could feel secure about it. Or some people have proposed that, you know, an international body would be in charge of protecting these, and you would have rotating countries overseeing that oversight. There are different arrangements. It's not as though there are ready-made answers to this. A lot of deliberation would be required, but being able to deliberate again would be a step forward rather than being just passively sitting there hoping no one uses it. Because if it were used, whether by a terrorist, a rogue state, or much more likely by a state, and I say much more likely simply because you have to go through thousands of steps to get this architecture ready. The nuclear arsenal is ready because the states have gone through the thousands of steps. The terrorists didn't go through 1,000 steps to get it in place. It's there to be used and misused because of what we did. And we ought to take the steps to dismantle it.
That was Professor Elaine Scarry on Thermonuclear Monarchy, Choosing Between Democracy and Doom. Elaine Scarry is Professor of Aesthetics and General Theory of Value at Harvard. Among her books are Thinking in an Emergency, Rule of Law, Misrule of Men, On Beauty and Being Just, Dreaming by the Book, and The Body in Pain. Elaine Scarry spoke on January 11, 2015 at the Wellington Avenue Church in Chicago. Thanks to Dale Lehman for the recording. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.